Good. So, welcome everybody. Okay, so everybody feeling well today? Yes? Yes? Feeling well today? Yes, good. That's good. That's good. Everybody should feel well, at least before this lecture. Okay, so today we will do something really, really cool. So we will do a refresher course. Who knows variational calculus? Yes? One? Who else? Okay, today we'll do something really cool. So we will talk about variational calculus and why variational calculus is a really nice and useful tool. Variational calculus is it's essentially an extension of the analytic algebra that you already know today, and it's really, really useful because you can not just work with functions of variables, but we will introduce something which we call a functional, and this functional is a function of functions, and then we can operate on the functional in a quite similar way as we do with functions, and we can look at extreme situations and things like that. And the nice thing about it is that I don't have to do many constraints on that functions that we are dealing with. So I can solve a functional for a function. And in the end we will see a quite trivial example, but this is a quite nice way of looking at things. So I'll try to keep it slow. Ask all your questions on the way. Yeah? If there's only one guy in the audience who's already familiar with this, then we probably take the kind of slower approach. But this is, so if you get the idea, you will immediately agree that this is pretty cool. Okay? Good. What do we want to do? Why is it a useful tool? Well, let's think of a problem as we have it in image processing all the time. Let's say we want to compute a smoothed image, and we want to compute it according to some selected optimality criterion. And the model, the assumptions that we put in, should be that we have a filtered image G. And G, the result of our filtering, so the smoothing, G should be as similar as possible to the original image F. And then, so they need to be similar, so probably the difference or the distance between the two functions should be small. And of course, G should be smooth. Yeah? So this is what we can put in. And now we don't want to think of the discrete images as we traditionally use them in this class. Now we think of the image as a continuous function. And the nice thing is we basically, if we stay in a continuous domain, we don't really have to describe how this image is exactly modeled. So we could model our image with pixels. Then we have a discrete version, a version that we know. But we could also model the entire image as a mixture of Gaussians. And so it could be any other type of function, or our image could be a polynomial. Yeah? But in the following, we won't discuss how we actually model the image, and we will do the entire math without even looking into the model that we use for the image in high detail. Of course, in the end, when you go to an application, you probably have to choose a model, otherwise you won't be able to implement it. But you can already start deriving algorithms without detailing the model. So you can produce a scheme how to solve a particular class of problems without having to describe the actual model, how, in our case, the image. Later, we want to use that for registration, and you can do the same. So you can describe a registration algorithm, a non-rigid registration algorithm, and the deformation is then handled as an arbitrary function. And because we are not talking about how this function really has to look like, we can later put in a B-spline model, or we do vector fields. So a vector field is a vector at every voxel position in the volume. So vector fields are pretty large, and you have to store a lot of numbers. And often you want to reduce that, and then you subsample the volume and use something smooth, like a field of B-splines, or you can choose a very different other model. But we won't be dealing about these models today. We will be talking about how to tackle the problem without having to describe too much the model, not too much, because there's some constraints. So for example, if you take derivatives, the function, you must be able to derive the function and things like that. So these are the constraints that then come in, but we will only talk about properties like how often the function can be derived and stuff like that. But we won't have to define the actual model itself. We will just talk about properties of the model, and we can already go down towards a solution without doing that. So this is a very important point. And this will be also important at some point. You may have to explain this to someone in a specific situation. Let's say you're in a bar in the evening and you want to talk about functional calculus. Then this is probably a suitable situation where you then remember this class and say, hey, do you know this about functional calculus? Yeah. Okay. So there might be situations in your future where this comes in quite handy. And let's talk a bit about this, the problem. Let's stay with our example. And now our example is still this moving. And now we have this nice functional here. We have two functions. We have f and g. So f is the reference. G is our smooth, the image. And what we now want to do is, well, we want to integrate over the entire domain of the image, which is essentially the part of the image that we are able to observe. And when we do this integration, we want to take all values of f and all values of g, subtract them from each other, and square them. So this is just a normal sum of squared distances. So if you had a discrete case, then you would have, instead of the integral, you would have a sum, and you would iterate over all your pixels and just add up the sums. Yeah? So you essentially state by this term that you want the input and the output to be close together. And then you add something else here, and this is also something that we do all the time. We add regularization. And regularization now enforces the criterion that we want our output image to have. And in this case, we enforce, so this is the gradient of our output image. And we say that the LP norm of our gradient should be small. Yeah? So we want the entire norm over the entire image. So we want this to be small. And so here we have the data consistency term, and here we have the regularizer term, and we put the two together by some kind of weighting factor, and this is typically called the regularization parameter. So we do this kind of problems all the time, and this is how you build an optimization problem that you later then want to optimize. So far, so good. But now, so we're integrating over the entire domain, so this is dx, dy, so we have a two-dimensional problem. And you may already notice that I'm kind of simplifying the notation here. So in fact, if I were be exact, I would have to write down here f of xy, g of xy, and of course the same here. So I'm slightly abusing the notation here because we will need that, otherwise we would have very long equations now. So we are skipping those parts. But keep in mind that f and g are functions, but we will use them as kind of variables. So you can think about it as kind of variables. Okay, good. So everybody here now agrees that this, if we optimize this function with respect to g, then we will get something that will be similar to f, and it should be smooth, right? Good. Everybody agrees. That's good. I see one guy nodding, so this means everybody agrees, right? Good. And now the problem is, how can we minimize this functional d of fg with respect to G. And the solution is very simple. It's calculus of variations, variational calculus. There you go. So now, how can we do that? Well, maybe we want to think about variational calculus first a bit, and then we can think about how to solve this particular problem. Okay, so let's go a step back. Before we now start dealing with functionals and how to optimize them, let's go one step back. And we will talk now about regular derivatives and how we did that in calculus, how we could compute derivatives and how that worked. Okay. So if you want to derive a function, what you're essentially doing, so you write this as the differential of f of x with respect to x. And what you do, you kind of try to find you kind of try to find an infinitesimally small step and in which direction this step goes. So what you do is you take the function at the position f of x plus epsilon, and then you subtract f of x, and you divide over epsilon. Now, if you do that, you can determine the derivative. Yeah? So we know that. We've seen that plenty of times. And we can also extend this. We can extend this to vector-valued functions. So if we do that, then we can also do something which we call a directional derivative. So let's say we want to compute the derivative with respect to the direction u. And now u is a vector, and the function is vector-valued. Then we can compute the derivative or the gradient in direction u, and we write this as the same notation as previously, but now we are not going a scalar value of epsilon, but we are taking the vector u times epsilon into that direction, and then we can compute a directional derivative. Okay? So you all know that. This is just a refresher, and you can then write this down in a short notation. So this would be the partial derivative into the direction u with, and you can write it as a partial derivative of x plus epsilon u and partial e, a partial epsilon. Okay? Good. Now let's extend this. So let's first look at a couple of properties. So if you consider real-valued functions, so you have a d-dimensional space and you project into a scalar space, then you will find a minimum at a location where the gradient of x star, so x star is now a minimum, or extremal position, and at that position your gradient will be zero. You all know that. And we use that in optimization quite frequently. In particular, if you have a convex function that you want to optimize, you will be looking for the derivative. And if you find a place where the derivative is zero, you know that this is an extremal value. And if you know that is a strictly convex function, then it will be a unique minimum of the function. So we all know that. Yeah? Okay. Good. So now let's expand this. So in variational calculus, we will have some kind of real-valued functional. And now we call this functional I. And I of f maps functions f in the space of functions that can be derived twice to real numbers. And if now f0 is a minimum of the functional, then this function f0 needs to satisfy the corresponding Euler-Lagrange equation. Yeah? So this is the entire thing what we are aiming at. So what we want to show now is we want to derive a similar property, like we know if a gradient of a function is zero, then we know that we have an extremal value. And what we will do now is we want to look into a condition that is also able to describe us where a minimum of this functional is. And we will show in the next couple of slides that what we do with derivatives in normal calculus, we can do in variational calculus using the Euler-Lagrange partial differential equation. So this will be the corresponding part to our well-known derivatives, to our derivative zero property that we have for extreme values in normal functions. Yeah? So this is the entire point that we are aiming at. And a nice thing is, if our functional is strictly convex, then f of f0 is going to be a unique minimum. So again, if we have convex optimization, we can make sure that it's going to be a unique minimum. So this is also very useful. Okay, and what do we do? Well, we now have to formalize our optimization problem. And we will describe it in the following way. So we need a set of functions, and the functions need to be defined in the interval x1, x2. And now we want to minimize some integration over our functional with respect to x. And our functional here then has the arguments, the variable itself, x, and then the function f and the function f prime. So what we do now is we are describing not just the function, but also properties of the derivative of the function. So we can find particular solutions then that describe us properties on the function and the derivative of the function. Of course, we somehow need to set boundary conditions. And these boundary conditions will be, so the interval starts at x1, and f of x1 will be the function f1, and f of x2 will be the function f2. So we also need some kind of boundary conditions to solve this optimization problem. And you see that in this case, we kind of already abused this notation, because the symbols f and f prime in the second and third variable of the function f, they look like variables, but they're instead but they're actually functions, and f and f prime are used for the function in the interval x1 x2 and its derivative. Okay, so this looks like these two guys, they look like normal variables, but they're actually functions. Yeah. Okay, and in order to find a minimization of this functional, we will need the Euler-Lagrange equation. And the Euler-Lagrange equation will state that if you take the partial derivative of f with respect to f, yeah, so this is a partial derivative of this function, of this functional x f f prime, and you subtract the total derivative over the entirety of x of the functional derived with respect to f prime, so this is the partial derivative of f with respect to f prime, then the entire thing needs to be zero. Okay? So this is the Euler-Lagrange partial differential equation. And in the following, we will derive this. So we will have a look how we can actually derive this property. And if this property is fulfilled, then you will then you have found a function that minimizes the functional. Okay? Good. Yes?
What's the partial derivative with respect to a function?
Yeah, that's it. Well, we will see more examples. Yeah. So we will put in examples. Yeah. So let's stick with this, and then it should get clearer with the examples. Okay. Good. Now, what we can do now is we want to exactly look into how we can actually get these derivatives right. And what we do now is we do something similar as we did for finding the derivative in our world of scalar functions, we added a small epsilon. And what we are actually doing in order to find a derivative with respect to a function, we are adding something that we call a perturbation function. So we slightly change the entire function using a different function. And this is a function that is very close to zero, but it slightly changes the function. So instead of using an epsilon, we will use this perturbation function. And in this way, we can calculate a derivative with respect to a function. Okay? Good. And of course, at the boundary conditions, our perturbation function needs to be zero. Because at the boundary points, it needs to go down to zero. Good. And the variation, so if we now scale the amplitude with some kind of epsilon, then even this variation should be small. So we want to do small changes in the function, and these small changes with the perturbation function will cause some similar effect as we have it for our partial derivatives. Okay, now we can define a new function, and this new function g of x is composed of the old function f of x plus epsilon times our perturbation function. And the derivative of this is going to be, well, quite easy. So if you derive this term, that will be the derivative of the original function plus epsilon times the derivative of the perturbation function. So keep this in mind. We will use this later. Good. Then we also have boundary constraints, and the boundary constraints are very nice because we defined our perturbation function to be zero at the boundary. So this means that the boundary constraints of g of x1 and f of x1 is the same, and it's f of it's f1. So this drops out because we defined our perturbation function in this way. So we can replace that at the boundary condition. So this is the reason why it will fall out, because we defined eta to be zero at the boundary. Good. Then let's continue. Now we can define a necessary condition of the optimum, which states, so we want to do the same as we had for the derivative. Now if we have an optimal position, if we have an optimal function, then even if we do so if we do a small step in the direction of eta and then take the functional of that and subtract the functional at the position f of x, then and divide over epsilon, then the this thing here should go to zero. So we can write this shorter. So this is our derivative with respect to epsilon of the functional g. So this is what we define as the functional derivative. So this is very similar as we had in the normal calculus. And this guy needs to be zero at an optimal position. So here we essentially have exactly the same condition as we already know from our previous theory. So this is the same as we have in calculus. This is the necessary condition for an optimum. And now we can think about this derivative here, and we can rearrange it a bit. And what we do is, well, again, so you already recognize this equals zero. This is already the left part of the Euler-Lagrange partial differential equation. Yes?
Can you please tell me, in physically, what does it mean by this? I mean, what is actually this functional signifies to what in terms of the image? What value?
The functional, so this I.
Yeah.
So I is your complete optimization problem. So I is the optimization problem composed of the data consistency term plus the regularizer. This is I. this is our functional that we want to optimize. This is typically data consistency plus regularization. This is I. Okay? And now we want to optimize I with respect to F. And we will see how to do that in the following. Huh? Okay, so the zero here we already know. This is already where we're aiming at. So we want to find this condition that describes us how we can, where we can find an optimal function, or what an optimal function with respect to our with our functional is. And in the next step, we just know this is the right-hand side. So this is our derivative with respect to epsilon of I of g. Then we can plug in our definition of I. So I was the integral from x1 to x2, so over the domain of I. And then we have our f in here, and f describes properties of g, g prime, and x itself. Huh? So this is the term that we want to, this is essentially the data consistency plus regularization. So this is our f. And the integration around here, so this is the integration over the entire domain of this problem. Okay? Now what we can do is we can rearrange. So we can, because the epsilon, this derivative can go in here. So we can pull it in here. And then we can think about what the derivative of f is with respect to epsilon. And what you need to consider, well, the x part doesn't contain anything with epsilon, so only g and g prime have epsilon. And now you can think about the original definitions. So g was f of x plus epsilon eta x, and g prime was f prime plus epsilon eta prime. And if you do that, then what you need to do essentially is just apply the chain rule here. So you need to derive this functional with respect to g, and then you preserve eta, and you derive with respect to g prime, and you will get eta prime here. Okay. And in the next step, we see that we don't have any epsilon in here anymore. So we can get rid of this constraint with epsilon. So we still have an integration. And now we have, the other thing that we can also get rid of is, of course, if we set epsilon to 0, then g and g prime will just boil down to f and f prime. And this is also happening here. So if epsilon equals to 0, then the entire perturbation function just cancels out. So this is happening in this step here. But we still have the, because we took the derivative with respect to epsilon, we still have the perturbation function and its derivative in here. Okay. The next step, we need to think a bit about partial integration and properties of partial integration. And one property of partial integration, if you have an integral from A to B of u times v prime dx, then you can rewrite this as the integration function or as the function u times v, the function u times v at A from A to B. Yeah? So you can rewrite it as here, and then subtract the partial integration of from A to B, where you do the partial derivative of u prime and v. So you can do that, and we can do that in the following. So we can think of the second term on the previous slide. And this was our second term on the previous slide. And we can do the same here. So we can think of the integration function here. And this entire integration function you will have to put in the boundary conditions x1 and x2, and we know that eta of x1 and eta of x2 is zero. So if you multiply something with zero, it's going to be zero. So the entire term here is going to be zero. Okay. And so in this way, we can show the identity between the integration of this term here and this term over here. And now, of course, you have to compute the total derivative of this functional here. Okay? So this is the same step as we did up here. So here we had the derivative with respect, the derivative of v times u, and now we end up with u derivative times v. So this is why we have eta here, and we had eta prime here, and now we have the total derivative with respect to x of our functional here. Huh? So this is how we can show that. Now we can plug that in into our original formulation, and this will yield that we have the integration from x1 to x2, and now this functional up here, it is all multiplied with eta x, so we can pull out eta x. So you see, this is the first part, this was multiplied with eta x, and the second part was multiplied with the derivative of eta x. And now we can pull out eta x because we applied this trick here. So now we have some rather long functional here multiplied with eta x, and the integration of this guy needs to be zero. Okay. Now we can use another trick. And the next trick is, if you have an integration from a to b, and the integration from a to b of a function g of x times h of x is zero, then this integration will only be true if you have the boundary conditions of h of a and h of b equals to zero. And if this is really true, then g of x needs to be zero over the entire domain. Which means it doesn't matter what our perturbation function is. If we have this constraint that some function times another function and the entire integration over here is zero, and we know that the boundary conditions of h of a and h of b are zero, then g of x needs to be zero. Yeah? So what we do is, our g of x is now this function here, and our h of x is essentially eta. So we can kick out eta. It doesn't matter what our perturbation function is, because the entirety of g of x needs to be zero in order to make this integration true. Yeah? So this means, if we apply that, we can derive the Euler-Lagrange equation in its final form. And this is going to be the functional f derived with respect to the function f minus the total derivative of the function derived with respect to f prime. Okay? So this is interesting, because you have a function in here and you derive it with respect to f, and then you have another total derivative in here and a derivative with respect to the derivative of the function, what we are looking at. Okay? So let's think a bit about this total derivative, and let's think a bit about the following functional. In this functional, we can define this functional as x times, so this is just an example, yeah? So this is the example, x times f of x to the power of 5 plus f prime of x to the power of 2, okay? And I don't specify whatsoever what f of x is. So f of x can be any function that I can derive at least two times. And now we can compute the partial derivative with respect to f, and you will get the following. Well, if you derive this functional with respect to f, only the first part is dependent on f, so you can neglect the derivative here. So we do it in a very similar way as we would work with normal variables. So the partial derivative with respect to f is going to be 5x times fx to the power of 4. So I'm just using the normal rules as I would compute derivatives on variables. So this will give us the partial derivative with respect to f, and this is the partial derivative with respect to f prime. And you see this part is not dependent on f prime, so it cancels out, and then it's just 2 times f prime x. Okay? So this is how you compute those partial derivatives with respect to a function. Okay? Good. Then we can also think about the total derivative, and the total derivative is essentially the derivative in all components of f prime. So you have to compute the partial derivative with respect to x, the partial derivative with respect to f, and the partial derivative with respect to f prime. So this is the total derivative, and you just sum the three up. This is a total derivative. Or you could rewrite it as f prime comma x, f prime f, and then you need to apply the chain rule, and f prime, so you need to derive 2 times with f prime and then multiply with f prime prime. But most of the time we just use the shortcut and describe this as the total derivative, because in implicit form, using the total derivative, this is very short. But if you really write down the total derivative entirely, you get a not as elegant notation. But this is then your stable point. This is your optimal point. And if you have now a functional that you can bring in this form, you can really set this equation, and this will give you a function that is optimal with respect to your functional. Okay, so let's think about a problem, and let's stay in some domain that we already know. We want to find the shortest connection between two points, and the points are going to be x1, y1, and x2 and y2. And now what we do is, so all of you of course know the shortest connection between two points is a line, if you use the Euclidean distance. Yeah? So what we will do now is, we will take the Euclidean distance and use the properties of the Euclidean distance to show that the shortest connection of two points is a line. And we will do that using variational calculus. And what we do first is, so you can define your distance as the Euclidean distance. So you will have x square, y square. And then we can rearrange this a bit by pulling out the x here. So you can rearrange it to the following notation. So you divide over x squared, and then you pull it out of the square root, and you will get this. So if you multiply this into the square root, you will get with the original. You will get to the original formulation. Now our functional is going to be the integration over all possible values of x, and now x is essentially all possible combinations of points. So we want to show really that for all points in the entirety of our domain, we want to show that the shortest, what is the shortest connection. Yeah? And this means that our functional essentially becomes this form. And the nice thing is now that only the derivative of f pops up at this point. So we can now compute the partial derivatives with respect to f and with respect to f prime. And the partial derivative with respect to f is going to be 0. And the partial derivative with respect to f prime is going to be f prime over the square root. Yeah? Okay. So if we continue, then we plug this in into our Euler-Lagrange partial differential equation. And we know that the derivative with respect to f was 0, so we skip this part. And then we still need to compute the total derivative with respect to our second part. And the derivative, so now we have a function here, and this function is only composed of derivatives. And this function is going to vanish if the original function is a constant, okay? Which means that the derivative of our function needs to be a constant. Yeah? So we can show this now, that this is only gonna vanish if this is gonna be a constant. And this is an equation in f prime. So we can now solve this. So this is going to be a constant. And we can now solve for f prime, which means that f prime is needs to be a constant c. And f prime actually needs to be c over the square root of 1 minus c to the power of 2. But this essentially tells us that the derivative of our function needs to be a constant. Well, and if you now have which functions do you know whose derivative is a constant? It's lines, yes. So now we have shown, surprise, surprise, f is a straight line. Yeah? But we now have shown it with respect to variational calculus. And we never looked actually into the actual modeling of this connection. We only looked into the properties of the function. And this, so in the end, we plug in some kind of model. We plug in this model mx plus t. Yeah? But we can show up to the point that the derivative of the function needs to be a constant, that we haven't even considered how the structure of f is at all. And we can derive properties on f without even having to choose a particular set of functions. And now we've seen that this set of functions needs to be lines. Otherwise, it is not the shortest path. OK, good. Of course, we can also do more with that. And in order to do that, you probably want to add higher order derivatives. So let's say you don't just have properties on the first order derivative, but also second order derivatives and so on. Let's say you want to deal with curvature. Then the Euler-Lagrange equation scales up as follows. And you have an alternating sign here, and you have the partial derivative of f with respect to f prime, dx. So this is already the part that you know. And now if you add higher order derivatives, you get again total derivatives and with respect to the functional and matching higher order derivatives. And you have an alternating sign here. So this is how the Euler-Lagrange equation would scale up if you add more higher order derivatives. And you can show something similar if you add functions. So you could have more than one function that you want that you wish to constrain. So you could put in a function f1 and a function f2, and then the respective partial order, the respective partial derivatives. And what happens then is you get several Euler-Lagrange equations. So you get several of them. And you get as many equations as you have functional dependences. Then you can also go to higher dimensional spaces. So you could have functions in f of, so you could have functions in x and y. So like we have images, we typically have functions in x and y. And what happens then is that you have to be careful with the boundary constraints, of course. And what happens then is that you get also derivatives with respect to x and derivatives with respect to y. So you end up with the derivative of f with respect to f, and then the derivative with respect to fx, and the derivative with respect to fy. Yeah? And you can derive it in a very similar way. Okay. Don't worry about this too much. You can go back to the slides and look this up if you want to solve a respective problem. Yeah? So you don't have to memorize all this. But what I really expect that you are able to tell me is the Euler-Lagrange equation in its implicit form. Yeah? So I would expect that you know this equation and that you can explain this equation to me. Yeah? You know what it means, what a functional is, and what the difference between a function and a functional is. Okay, good. We can scale this up to 2D case. And now that we have talked about all these points, we can now go back to our original problem. So our original problem was that we wanted to solve this functional. And we had the image similarity and the smoothness constraint in here. And we can rewrite this slightly. And you will see that the remaining functional that we get is going to be dependent on x, y, g partial derivative x, and g partial derivative y. Okay, because this gradient here is essentially, if you plug in the L2 norm, it's essentially this guy here. Okay. So we get a functional that is dependent on x, y, g, gx, and gy. Now you can go back to the previous slides, assemble the correct Euler-Lagrange equation. And what you need to do is you also need to compute the partial derivatives of your functional with respect to g, gx, and gy. And you can, if you compare it here, so this is your functional here, this is the f. And now if you derive this guy with respect to f, then the 2 comes down and you get g minus f. And if you take the partial derivative with respect to gx, then only this part is relevant, and you will see that the gy part is irrelevant, so the 2 comes down and you remain with mu times gx. So this is mu times gx, and this is mu times gy. And now we have the matching derivatives, and we can plug this into our Euler-Lagrange equation that is for this case. And this is the following equation. So we have a 2D problem and we have gx and gy. So this exactly matches one of the previous examples. And then we can plug this in. And you will see, so we already, now we add the xy component. So previously we were omitting this. Now we also put this in here. So this is gxy minus fxy, and then the total derivatives here. And you will see that if you actually compute this, then this is nothing else than your Laplacian at this location. So what you end up is g of xy minus f of xy times mu times our Laplacian. Okay. Good. So now we need to find a function g that satisfies this equation. Yeah. This needs to be zero. But at this point now, we have to think about some kind of model that we plug in. And then depending on the model, how we model g, we can pick up different solution schemes. But we stop at this point. So the Euler-Lagrange equation is very useful because you get some description of an optimal point of a function. This leads then to partial differential equations, and what you typically do is you take a numerical solver that is suited for partial differential equations. And yeah, then we neglected the entire trick of the discretization of this. And typically you use finite difference approximations and linear systems of equations. Good. In images, you can have quite natural boundary conditions. So you could n transposed equals to zero on the boundary condition where n is the normal vector to the boundary. So this means, okay, so you could define a boundary condition that you have a constant extrapolation, for example, for your image. But you can also find other boundary conditions. But a typical one would be that you expect a constant behavior towards the outside of your image. So if there's nothing to observe, you just observe it. You just expect it to behave constant. The normal of the derivative has to vanish at the image boundaries, and numerically. Yeah, so one way how you can enforce this is either that you expand the image by a constant value, you just take the last value in the image and just make it constant, or you can also mirror your image. You just take the image and mirror it, and then you can also have the normal of the derivative vanish. Okay. Okay, there's a direct. So we didn't talk much about linear diffusion, right? So I'm not sure if we should talk about the connection to diffusion. So essentially, you can also derive diffusion and diffusion smoothing. So what we just did is we had a functional where we had a constraint on the smoothness of the image, but you can replace the smoothness term by some potential function which penalizes large gradients less severely. So you can put in some penalization function where you say large gradients are okay and smaller gradients are not desired. And if you do that, you end up with nonlinear diffusion. And this is then called Perona-Malik smoothing. And in this term, you completely ignore the similarity term, but you just do diffusion of the image. So you can also derive Perona-Malik is a very popular algorithm for a nonlinear diffusion denoising. And now you can plug this in, and of course we can again use our partial derivatives and our Euler-Lagrange equations, and what you end up is essentially the Perona-Malik diffusion equation. Okay. Good. Do you have questions now? Forget about the diffusion part too much, so we won't go into much detail in this. So the take-home message here is, yes?
On slide 16, we have the fundamental lemma of variational calculus.
16.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you say, let's say we have h of x to be constant zero. Why does that imply that g of x needs to be zero too?
Excuse me? Can you repeat? Yeah, but you are solving for h of x in this case. So if you're solving for something that you already know that it's zero, then you don't need to solve.
Okay.
Yeah? You're solving for g of x, and you say that you want to place h of x zero of the over the entirety, yeah. But then you are solving some integration where you always multiply with zero. But h of x was our perturbation function, so it needs to be non-zero. It needs to be non-zero at some point. If our perturbation function would be zero over the entirety domain, then it wouldn't perturb, right? So you would be so if you think back to a normal calculus, it would be that you are not your epsilon is zero all the time, so you're not doing a step. So let's say, or let's go to the directional. Let's go to this directional derivative. So what you're essentially proposing is to plug in a zero vector here. So if you try to compute the partial derivative in a direction that has only zeros in it, it doesn't make any sense to compute that direction. So your perturbation function needs to be non-zero at some point. Otherwise, you are not giving any direction into your derivative, right? So you can compare with this example. So what you probably want to do here is take a vector where you have all zeros but one. Yeah? So you want to use a basis vector probably and compute with respect to a base direction of your coordinate system. So it needs to be non-zero at a particular point. If it were zero over the entire domain, then of course you wouldn't need this. Then your integration would also be zero. But we know that h of x needs to be non-zero at some occasions because otherwise it wouldn't perform this perturbation. And therefore, g of x needs to be zero. Okay?
What happens if you say that h of x is defined to be zero at the boundaries and otherwise one? And you take your own
derivative. Yeah. Yes, it has to be smooth. We had this constraint also in here. So eta x has to be, you have to be able to compute the derivative two times. If you have something which has jumps in there, you have a problem. It has to be smooth. Okay, more questions. Who wrote down questions to slides after 16? Okay, take-home messages. So we found that we can formalize image processing in terms of variational problems. And the nice thing is we will see that. So now we've talked only about images as functions, but you can describe anything else also as functions. So we will actually in the next lecture, we will use this and describe image deformations as functions. And if you talk about image deformations, there's many things that you can do to deform an image. Yeah? So we can have many different models, but you can use this math to derive the solution up to the point where you have to pick the model. So you can derive the entire registration algorithm independent of the actual model that you're going to plug in later. And this is pretty cool. So this is why this is very useful. And of course, you need some time. You heard this for the first time now, except for you. And it will take some time to go through these slides and follow them. But this is actually really nice. So this is it's really useful. And you can write brilliant papers with this, because you can formalize many problems in a very abstract way. And then you can show stuff like that the shortest path between two points is a line. Yeah. Okay. Good. Remember the Euler-Lagrange partial differential equation in the implicit form. Remember that one and tell me what it's useful for. It's useful to find minima or extremal values in a functional space, in a function space. So it's essentially the equivalent of setting a gradient to zero in what you do in the typically Cartesian spaces, so on. And have a look at the examples. So this example with the shortest path, it's somewhat obvious, but you can show it in a very complicated way. There's also very nice reads and books on variational calculus. And these two I can really recommend, and they also lead into that type of math. And you can imagine what we just did is we just dipped very closely onto a subject, but we are just looking into the opening of the rabbit hole, but there's actually much more deeper down there. We will look into a bit how we can use this for non-rigid registration, and then we go to a different topic. But you can go much further down this way, and it's a lot of fun. Okay. Any more questions? Probably tons of questions, but you don't want to ask them on tape. Okay, then see you next Tuesday. And of course, if you still have questions, you can come up here after the lecture.